This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
BBC Sounds, music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Emma Barnett and welcome to Woman's Hour from BBC Radio 4.
Good morning and welcome to the programme. It is the 60th anniversary of Doctor Who today, so who better to have on the programme than the first female Time Lord, Jodie Whittaker. She's my first guest this morning, and we will hear how you follow that role. A clue for you, powerful women's stories. Another woman on the programme today in search of the next chapter is England's outgoing Chief Inspector of Schools, Amanda Spielman, who's coming to the end of her tenure at the helm of Ofsted. This year, the Education Watchdog has come under intense scrutiny over its inspection regime, and in particular, the use of single-phrase judgments of schools, things like outstanding or good. But who is Ofsted for? Have you used it? Do you read its reports? Have you relied upon them to make the school choices for those in your life, if you've had that responsibility? How should we, even if you haven't had that responsibility, I'm sure you'll have a view, how should we assess those who assess our children? Or do you think, like a report out this week made a recommendation, that we should scrap such inspections? Is it something that is now of the past and we should be looking at this in a completely different way? We have come through, not in all senses, and certainly with children, you can argue definitely not come through to this point yet, but we have come through a pandemic and lockdown and things very much changed for the youngest in society. Is it time to change the way we assess schools, or is it fine as it is? And we keep going and we learn from these reviews and these inspections, 24-hour notice given, and schools then are reviewed. I'm sure a lot of our listeners, if you're not at least listening live because you're in the classroom, we'll be hearing from you later because you will have a view on this. I know a lot of our listeners work in education, but I also want to hear from those who have to use such reports to make decisions about their children's education. Are they useful? How do you want them to change, if you want them to change? 84844, that's the number you need to text. At BBC Women's Hour on social media, tell me your take through an email to us via the Women's Hour website or send a WhatsApp message or voice note with 03700 100 444. Just watch those data charges. Now, it is my pleasure to be joined in the studio by Jodie Whittaker. Many of you will know her as the 13th Doctor in Doctor Who, the first female Time Lord. As I mentioned, it happens to be the 60th anniversary of the iconic show today, but ever since she finished that role, she's been attracted to the gritty stories of women's lives, and her most recent one is her role in a new Australian six-part drama called One Night. It's set in a coastal community in New South Wales, and the story centres around three women, the central theme being the rape of Jodie's character Tess 20 years previously when she was a teenager. And the friends' reunion after many years apart is intensified by the publishing of a novel based on their lives, written by one of them. Jodie Whittaker, I don't think I've given too much away there, but a bit of an overview.
Do you know what? That was excellent. And I need to learn from that because I've had that question a lot. Can you tell us what it's about? And yours is a much more succinct version. Well, mine goes off for 20 minutes.
We try to do these things well here on the team at Woman's Hour. But I will come to that because it's a really important part, how you choose these roles, what voices you're giving women's stories, how you're getting them to bigger platforms. But it is 60 years of Doctor Who.
Yes,
it just happens to be. So
should have worn a happy birthday badge or something. I know, I've really let myself down.
It's one of those quirks that you're here with us. So is it a day that you think about in a specific way? What are your feelings about this anniversary?
Do you know what? What is so extraordinary is to be a tiny cog in such a big wheel of absolute joy. It's my happiest time, my absolute happiness. of being a part of that show, that team. And I'm just so excited for the next steps and to be an audience member.
Which is what you
have
are.
The responsibility.
You're not involved with these celebrations.
No, and this is not some kind of like sneaky snakes. I am definitely not involved. This isn't going to be that then I pop up somewhere. I'm definitely not.
But was that because you wanted to be an audience member and just
enjoy
it?
I wasn't asked, love. No, it's like, but I'm like, I can take it. I've made it very, very public that I would definitely pop back at any point that I'm asked. Haven't been asked yet.
Why have they not asked the first woman back?
Well, because I think I've only just left. It's like,
true.
Give it a break.
You need a bit of distance
my time.
On the breakup.
I think the fans have earned a break now, from 13.
There is a very cool fact, though, to raise about this, about you being a woman. And I know you've obviously been asked. No, but you've been asked a lot about how did people take it? What was the response? But the only doctor with two hearts.
I know. See,
can we talk about this?
You can. Well, it's the first,
tell us.
First method moment. I was very early pregnant. No one knew. And I had this very intense moment where I did think, oh my gosh, there's quite a lot of noise around my casting. There's a lot of joy, but there's also a lot of that I wasn't qualified, and suddenly I'm the most qualified.
So for people who don't know Doctor Who and what we're talking about.
So the character of the Doctor has two hearts. So yeah, so at that point, for those few weeks in the regeneration episode, there I was.
This is at your end, the end of you doing this role.
Yeah,
you were newly pregnant.
So it's a beautiful transition. It was the end of something incredibly special and the beginning of something else.
And I loved as well, I read when you were asked of your favourite moment, you talked of one of your monologues, which included the words, "None of us know for sure what's out there. That's why we keep on looking, keep your faith, travel hopefully. The universe will surprise you constantly."
Yeah. And it's one that if you meet, I have really beautiful interactions with a lot of Whovians, and very often if they want a quote written down, it's very often that, travel hopefully. And it just is such, but I think Chris is writing for me. I was just gifted absolute joy in the limitlessness of it. It's such an interesting character to play because you're not constrained with time periods, with etiquette of a certain world, or with human interactions, you have the freedom to express yourself in whatever way you see fit in that moment. And I think that's a very unique character to play, somebody that can be so mercurial.
Did you feel qualified in the end as a woman, as Doctor?
Yeah, that qualification of being born not an alien to play an alien. I felt massively qualified.
With the two hearts, because you're the one who took it to that level.
I know. I was very method.
I think you've got to own that as much as you can. You talked about that being some of the happiest working time of your life, because it's safe to say, Jodie, you don't go towards some of the most joyful roles some of the time, in the sense that they really test you, they take you to different places. And it's interesting, I was reading you saying that you've started to realise you don't always realise the impact of some of the difficult stories on you.
Yeah, I think this was the thing. When I started doing Doctor Who, I realised that I'm definitely, you know, I'm not method. I don't stay in character in between scenes. Often if I've got a really difficult dialect, I'll just keep talking in it. But that in itself is rare, because I don't feel like I can articulate myself unless I'm Broad Yorkshire. And a lot of my isms don't translate into a different accent. So even that. But, you know, you keep yourself in a certain mood. But it wasn't until I kind of stepped away and bounced around the universe for three seasons that I realised that actually, you know, if you're playing particularly someone like Beth Latimer in Broadchurch, you know, that's a five-month season that we shoot for. That it stays, the heaviness of it kind of is in there. I'm very lucky. It's not my life, but there is I feel a responsibility to at least commit wholeheartedly in those moments, so that there feels that it's authentic. And I think something like One Night appealed to me. Weirdly, everything about it was on paper not what I was looking for, in the sense of I was, you know, I'd got a little baby at home. You know, I'd been away for a really long time with the family, like from between Cardiff and London, all that kind of thing. And I was like, if I'm going to go back, I think maybe something quite light and probably round the corner, a bit practical. And all of those things, it was not.
No, you took your family to Australia.
Yeah, so we went to Sydney for four and a half months. And it was the most extraordinary thing. But that is because I opened this script. It was very much one of those, you can appreciate, it's middle of the night. You're awake because you're the only ones awake at this stage in your life. And I started to read, and even though I knew I should definitely sleep because someone else was asleep, I should be using this window, I caned 3 episodes in one go, and I couldn't. I was just immersed. And the beauty of it for me was I was immersed instantly in an episode where the POV is absolutely Simone, which isn't my character. And I hadn't even met Tess. And I was like, I need to be a part of this. I think it's incredible.
Let's play a clip from it.
What do you remember?
Want to hear my news? A novel's being published.
What is it about?
I don't want to give too much away. This is a page you missed on your contract. Your characters are fictional, you made up a town, it's all good.
How could you write about this without asking us?
So I mentioned there, the friends come back together, your character has moved away, tried to move on and put this terrible time behind her, and another character has decided to write up the story without the permission.
Yes.
And the female friendship, just first of all, is so well written, isn't it? And yeah. I must say, you're brilliant in this. I haven't said that.
Oh, thank you very much. You kind of need to say it, though. You're looking directly at me if you give me a one-star review.
I would just say, if regular listeners to this programme, just know I probably don't say anything.
Yeah, okay, great. Okay, I'll take it. I'm wrong with it.
But no, you know, I've been a fan of yours for a long time. We were having a discussion. I saw you in the film Venus very early on in your career, and I feel I discovered you because that moment.
And I'm going to get that tattooed. Discovered by.
Yes, exactly. That moment of feeling connected with an actor. But in this, there is an amazing drawing of female friendship.
Yes.
How deep it goes. And is that what drew you?
I think perspective and the POV of this story was so important.
Point of view, I think we're going with.
Yeah, it was so important to me because I have watched and read stories that centre around maybe a sexual assault or, you know, and that, or that being a theme within a story. What was very unique to me was that this wasn't the outside looking in. This wasn't the police detectives. This wasn't the survivor of that attack being kind of the third party being talked about. This was an internalisation of what one horrific event can do to not just one person, but to the friendship, to the community, all those things. But you seeing it differently every time. So what's really clever, I think, is that the first 3 episodes, you know, the one follows Simone, one follows Hat, played by the Yael Stone, Simone played by Nicole Da Silva, and then the third ep is from the POV of Tess, and it carries on like that. So we're forever seeing life present day, but also we use incredible flashback, and it's so beautiful. You can be in scenes looking in a mirror and see the younger version of yourself. That the power of keeping it, this event, current throughout with the use of flashback, and that way of storytelling felt really unique.
Your character's mum took an approach that some may be able to relate to with different generations, which is what had happened to you, chalk it up to experience, advises you not to get drunk again. That is an attitude in there, isn't there?
I think what's clever is that because this happened 20 years previously, we do have the vocabulary and the terminology of the time, and also the treatment that you kind of unfortunately would expect. But what's also really clever is showing that in 20 years, it hasn't necessarily moved that forward.
Yeah.
So I think that is really powerful, and we can see it as historical, but the present day conversation around consent it hasn't moved forward enough.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I mean, we're still kind of trying to get there in some ways, and how it's looked after and how the police deal with it, and,
yeah,
and how it is talked about in, yeah, society as well as prosecuted.
I think what's also really good is that you see when we are in scenes, like often I could be talking to, say, Simone present day, but then in that moment it could flash back to the 20-year-old, 19-year-old Simone, and I'm having that conversation. And I think what is really clever is that we can move on, but we're still, our memories, when something traumatic happens, you still, that moment kind of never moves forward, and the snapping back, and you're not entirely certain when these images or these senses are going to come to you. And I think the use of cinematography and the use of music and the use of kind of heightened realism and a kind of dream world often within a very naturalistic drama made this elevated to me in a way that I felt like I hadn't read.
I mentioned that you've gone towards the grittier side of life and the roles that you are in at the moment. And some people might be watching you in something completely different. The second series of Time,
yes,
which is currently available on the iPlayer. I actually had the writer in the other day talking about this. And it's a depiction of prison and women's lives, yeah, in the female estate. You play Orla, and you're serving your sentence. You've got children, and it shows a very realistic portrait of the chaos that is caused around poverty and a lack of support, yeah, and how women's lives are impacted. This is actually at a time where perhaps there will be changes to the justice system and how women are punished.
Yeah.
But I wonder what made you go towards that? What did you want to do with that?
Well, initially it just was, you've been offered Orla in Time season two, and Jimmy's work I'm incredibly familiar with, and it'd be, you know, first time working with Helen, and I didn't even need to read it because season one blew my mind.
So, Jimmy McGovern's first season,
yes,
which was
and so,
about men and
yeah,
and
so for me, I was just instantly like, yeah, and then I read it and I was like, oh my god, the kind of relevance and the ability to challenge our ideas of labels within all of our characters, and not just the kind of the three main characters that we follow, but with everyone. There's, you know, you could just go, you know, kind of single mum, criminal, drug addict, you know, woman suffering from mental health issues. No delving in, you know, just you get these headlines of people, and then actually when you explore it, the question of, particularly in Orla's point of view, the crime meets the punishment, and that absolutely doesn't marry. And the fact that what this person's crime that they've committed to what the catastrophic event on their life is, because of that, being taken out of society as a non-violent, non-threat to the community, in a time where everyone just talks about the cost of prisons and everything anyway, well, that costs a fortune to put Orla in prison. It then costs a fortune to put three children in the care system. It's you know, it made me rageful to read it, never mind to play it. And I loved that Jimmy and Helen, the writers, just have this amazing ability to throw big questions at you. And then it's for you to take it how you want. But for me as an actor, I was given so much in this, in just three episodes.
Yeah, a lot, a huge amount. And it has had a lot of people talking in a way.
Yeah,
that
it feels very current now in a way that it wasn't when we read it. It was, but then there's been conversations since it happening, you know, kind of comments about people living in tents, which is, as a spoiler, but relevant to all the character. And then obviously there's a reform at the moment about the sentencing for women.
Yeah, because the majority of those sentences are very short. So what will happen to those decisions, and perhaps not to go down the route of incarceration, and we'll see how that plays out. We had the Justice Secretary on the programme the other day just talking to that point. I think you've got a lot on. You've got a lot more coming out. I'm not going to get across all of those different things, but it's fascinating to hear, you know, the reason always why people go towards certain roles and what choices they're making and why. I did also love that I read that one of your rules of life, I did ask my editor if I could say this, and I've had special dispensation, is one of your rules is don't be an arsehole. And that's just something to live by, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, you know, I can be guilty of it sometimes, but I think it's definitely a rule that you've got to live by. Hey, so it's a long, you think you've earned your way up, it's a long way down, and it can be the click of a finger. So just don't take it for granted, and don't be rude.
Yeah. Although I love that I'm now allowed to say, you know, I'm quoting you. It's fine if
you
it's a
quote.
You
can get that tattooed.
We'll trade on this.
Yeah.
But on that point, what keeps your feet on the ground, do you reckon, when you are just going off to Australia, having to master an Australian accent, which we didn't necessarily get to?
But, yeah, yeah.
Well done there.
Oh, thank you. I think the thing is for me is just that it's life is absolutely joyous because I'm working in an industry that is really wonderful and really tough, and not everybody gets the opportunity to work, and I really don't think you can ever forget that. And I think that probably the most grounding thing is all my mates that are nothing to do with it, who, I mean, couldn't be less interested. in a positive way. And then I feel like no airs and graces there when you turn up.
That's good, and you need those people, don't you? But also, I feel like there must be something in there that you know that you do. Is there like a sort of dancing, roller skating, anything physical? I feel like is there something there, Jodie? Are we going to see you dancing on Strictly or anything?
Oh my gosh, I'd be rubbish. But I am literally hooked all weekend. But I'd be absolutely rubbish. I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of like screaming and singing around the house thinking I can sing. But I think for me, I've unfortunately got very few skills. And so I'm so lucky that I get to work in the one that I've got, which just being incredibly over emotional.
Jodie Whittaker, we'll take it. It's been a joy to have you on the programme. Thank you so much for talking
to
us. And the new series that we were talking about, One Night on Paramount Plus. There you go. While we've been talking, you've been listening to that, enjoying that, and I'm sure you'll be having some messages for us for Jodie. Again, as I say, on the 60th anniversary of Doctor Who. But some messages have been coming in while we've been talking about the role of my next guest, which is something you've got very strong feelings about, whether Ofsted reports actually help you make decisions. And I'm going to go through some of those messages because I'll tell you who's just walked into the studio, Amanda Spielman, who's coming to the end of an unprecedented 7 years at the helm of Ofsted, the organisation which inspects schools in England. It's been a turbulent period for education, not least because of the pandemic, which kept children at home for months at a time. This year, Ofsted's come under intense scrutiny over its inspection regime, in particular, the use of single phrase judgments of schools and the potential mental health impacts of those on school leaders and teachers. Many in the profession are now arguing that the current system is unfit for purpose and requires a complete overhaul. And I should say that Ofsted's annual report, which we'll go to a little bit now, came out this morning. Amanda Spielman, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here. I thought we could just start by using Ofsted's single phrase judgment methodology and ask how you rate your performance overall as you leave the role.
Well, we don't judge individuals at Ofsted, we judge organisations. And all the measures we use say that actually Ofsted is doing a really good job.
How do you think you're doing, though? Because you're leaving in December.
As I say, I'm going to talk about Ofsted. I don't judge individuals. But we've done what I set out to do when I came. We've created an inspection framework that's got very wide support in the system. We've beefed up inspector training. We've got to a place where 9 out of 10 schools say that their inspection is going to help them improve. I'm well aware that there are always people who are uncomfortable. But there has to be some kind of framework of accountability. And I think what we're really seeing is that there's a bit of an argument about whether there should be an accountability framework for schools. And Ofsted is sort of slightly caught in the crossfire.
It sounds like you think you've done an outstanding job, or good at least.
I'm not going to put a judgment on myself.
You say you've done what you've set out to do. I mean, that's just a... It's quite unusual as someone who's a chief inspector, you won't give a view on how you've done. But if we keep to this and carry on with your role, maybe we'll come back to that, is your top message in your final annual report as chief inspector out today is that the social contract between schools and parents is broken.
Yeah. Actually, my top message is that I think on a 7-year view, I think there's a lot of reason for optimism. This is my 7th and last year as chief inspector. Looking back across that time in education and care, we can really see an improvement in quality in that time. We can see that the focus on curriculum, on the substance of what's being taught, and whether that's happening with integrity, really is paying off. We saw that help schools through and after COVID. We've seen the improvements in reading in primary schools, improvements in teacher training, sort of slow but steady improvement in local authority, children's services. Across the board, there's real progress, and we can get very focused on the COVID hangover and lose sight of the long-term progress that really ought to be celebrated. But there is a COVID hangover, and the social contract is one of the things I want to talk about.
Yes. I mean, what do you mean that it's broken? Who's to blame?
Nobody's to blame. Blame isn't a helpful concept here. The point is that the disruption that came with lockdowns and school closures fractured that long-term understanding about the importance... But about the importance of schooling and about the importance of being consistent in attending school, that there's a very direct relationship between the amount of school children attend and how well they're likely to at the end of the day. So,
Can I just interrupt to say that for those who aren't aware of this, because this is the latest on this, the the average rate of persistent absence has doubled since before the pandemic. 28% of secondary school pupils are absent at least 10% of the time. If you just let that sink in for a moment, almost a third of secondary students are not attending school enough.
Absolutely. That's what we're talking about. That is a worry.
So what's broken?
Well, some of that is about more illness, and we know that mental health problems have increased. But some of it is about people, sort of families becoming more relaxed about children missing school for odd days or for term time holidays. A recent report pointed out that there simply was no stigma around term time holidays anymore. So across the board, there's somehow the loss of that understanding that the consistency, that every day, unless you're too ill, actually really matters to give children the best chance in the long term.
So how do we fix that?
Well, it's the slow, steady work from all directions. There's no quick fixes. There's no magic bullets. Schools have to work with parents to build their understanding of the school expectations. Parents have to play their part and accept school policy, school expectations from uniforms, behaviour policies, and so on. And so they have to be a mutually reinforcing system so that children get that consistency between home and school.
You talked about being very proud of your inspection system and how it's worked. It's noticeable when you talked about that 9 and 10 figure, it's based on a 48% response rate. I think that's an important detail. But do you think you did well in terms of allowances made? Because we are still very close to the pandemic. Do you think when inspections resumed in 2021, you made enough allowances for the effect of COVID on schools?
Yes, I do. And I think that's reflected in the fact that the judgment profile hasn't dipped post-COVID.
What does that mean, the judgment profile?
The overall proportions of schools judged outstanding, good, requires improvement, and inadequate in the system. We have just as many schools that are judged good or better as pre-pandemic. And that shows, actually, that the approach to inspection absolutely is taking account of the difficulties and recognising...
How does that show that?
Because we know that in some respects children's learning is behind where it was. We know that there are behaviour problems.
Oh, so you've made allowances,
So what those judgments that profile of judgments is showing is that the inspection approach is properly looking at the work that schools are doing and giving them credit for work.
I'm confused. If you look at a survey out this morning from the National Association of Head Teachers, its members, for those who don't know, make up the majority of school leaders in England. Many of them also work as your inspectors. It's pretty damning. 85% report they are unconfident or very unconfident in your organisation. That's 4 in 5 school leaders.
We've had many months of a lot of people trying to create anxiety from different directions.
Why would head teachers try to create anxiety?
We know that there is always some anxiety in the system about inspection. Inspection is a couple of things. One, it is the thing that connects government policy to what happens in schools. We are looking to see whether schools are doing what they're expected to do. That is always going to carry a bit of anxiety with it. And government operates a system of intervention, so disappointing inspection outcomes can lead to somebody else doing something. We are acutely aware of the pressure that creates. That's why all our inspectors are former leaders in schools themselves who've been at the receiving end, who've experienced
that. All of your inspectors
pressure.
Have that level of experience.
All of our school inspectors have to have 5 years of leadership expertise in schools.
Because it's also some of the questions that came in were talking about your inspectors and there not being enough of them who are experienced at that level. But you're saying that all of them are.
We have a requirement that of 5 years of leadership
and you're meeting that target.
In the education sector, yes.
Okay. Just going back to this, a bit of anxiety, fair enough. Yeah. 85% of heads are unconfident or very unconfident in your organisation. I've got a head teacher who's just written in here, Helen. She's called Helen, excuse me, saying Ofsted's become increasingly damaging for schools. It creates unnecessary stress for teachers and students. It is not fit for purpose. It should be reformed. More notice should be given. Constructive follow-up to help schools should be part of it.
So there are several things you've put in there.
She's not relying on her job anymore.
There are several things that are picked up in that. The first is that government divides up the responsibility. Ofsted's job is only the diagnosis piece, the inspection and reporting piece. The responsibilities for support and improvement and all the funding for them go to other bodies in the system. I cannot shift Ofsted resource into support work that sits with other people. It would be like the driving test agency saying it wasn't going to do tests anymore, it was going to run a driving school. if I said, right, we're going to move into support
No,
work.
But I'm not actually, so I'm only talking, if I go back to this Association of Head Teachers survey, which you seem to be just discounting, which I'm finding extraordinary, 78% of them, again, the majority, say they think Ofsted inspectors are not able to fully understand and evaluate a school in the time they spend on site. Only 12% believe you can do the job that you are there to do.
I haven't seen the survey.
Well, I have.
They haven't sent it to us, but we pilot.
You have to trust me on what I'm saying here. It's the headline findings.
We pilot inspection very carefully with the sector. We've got strong sector support for the model. We've done serious studies, looking at consistency between inspectors. We track the relationship between inspection judgments and school outcomes. We know that we have a high level of reliability. But there is no question that there's a great deal of activity in the sector to create anxiety, and that is something in itself. Anxiety feeds anxiety.
So are you
finding the ways to defuse this are really important because
you saying head teachers are feeding anxiety about the assessment of schools?
It's hard to say quite where, but it's very clear that anxiety is being ramped up, and I know that it is not coming from Ofsted. We have done
you're trying to create anxiety for anxiety's sake. But why can't you accept, if I just give you one more from this particular study, asked about the impact of Ofsted on the mental health and well-being of school leaders and school staff, the top five words, and I accept you've not seen this, but I'll share it with you, when asked how Ofsted made them feel, was anxious, sick, stressed, terrified and dread.
And yet, how does that fit? We do these, we send every single school a link to our post-inspection survey. So everybody who's uncomfortable has the chance to express that consistently.
To Ofsted.
9 in 10. To Ofsted, yes.
But would you tell an organisation that you didn't feel comfortable? Well, you might.
And this is after the inspection.
It has
no bearing whatever on their inspection. And we do third part, and we've started sort of third party surveys. We will be reporting. We do actually get a consistent feedback on the work on the ground. So there is a disconnect between what people say about the actual inspection they receive and what people say about inspection generally. And that's a really hard one for us as well.
This study, and I've particularly picked this one, but it's out today, but also because it's the Association of Head Teachers. They're talking about Ofsted inspectors not being able to understand and evaluate a school, and that they are not confident in it. And I suppose, I just want to get into, if you think teachers, head teachers, are creating anxiety, that's a very big insight from you as the chief inspector.
No, I didn't say it was head teachers creating anxiety. I said anxiety is being spun around the system and amped up. That is really hard for me to say. I don't think I can express an opinion that I can just see that anxiety is being pushed up.
It's not ghosts wandering around the education system. Who are the characters creating anxiety?
Well, I think it's the consequences of inspection that are the thing that causes the biggest fear. There was an Education Select Committee hearing a couple of weeks ago that all the unions appeared at, and they were asked what one thing would they most like to change about inspection. And they all said the consequences. And that is the thing that we have no control over, whatever. That, I'm afraid, sits outside Ofsted's responsibility. What we do is exactly what other inspectorates do. So the way we inspect, the way we report, it's exactly what happens for hospitals, for police forces, for care homes.
I'm not here to reflect on what is being said about your organisation. Or do you think it's your leadership, perhaps?
I don't think it's my leadership.
It's been pretty bad the last year under your leadership, hasn't it, though, the response?
There was a very sad case in the spring which has been used as a pivot to try and discredit what we do. The quality of what we do and the quality of what we do underneath has been solid for years. We have really strong feedback on our inspection framework. We know post-COVID there was a very clear message from the sector that they wanted to keep that framework, that it's as good as inspection has ever been. People are really positive about it. So somehow getting to a positive message about inspection in the sector is really, really important.
Are you talking about the death of the primary head teacher, Ruth Perry, when you talk about...
Yes, which I can't talk about specifically.
No, but if I can just remind our listeners, if you don't mind, the primary head teacher, Ruth Perry, died in January ahead of the release of a report that downgraded her school in Berkshire from outstanding to inadequate from the top to the bottom of the scale. There were reports in the media at the time she took her own life. Ruth Perry's sister, Professor Julia Walters, has since said... The injustice of the one-word judgment destroyed Ruth's career, her world and her sense of self. The inquest starts next week. We, of course, don't want to prejudice that legal process by talking about the specifics. But you did raise this and you say you feel it's being used in some way to discredit your organisation. By whom?
It's very clear there's been a tremendous amount of media coverage, and it's very hard to get people to understand that firstly, we inspect and report in exactly the same way, as I've said, for all inspectorates. There is nothing about what we do that is out of line, that treats schools particularly harshly. We're part of that wider and really important framework of public accountability for public services. Parents do need to know what's happening in their school. They want the reassurance if it's going well. And if it's not going well, they want to know that that's recognised and that action is being taken. So it is a tough job, but somebody does have to do it. And that's us. So we're getting a lot of pushback at the moment. And essentially, those calls amount to saying that there shouldn't be hard accountability in the system. And that's a really difficult one for us to counter, because we are set up precisely to be that lever that at the end of the day, we're the people who can say to parents, what your child is getting isn't good enough.
They have to have faith, though, in that the teachers also have faith in the system. And you've constantly said that you think that they do. But we've got a message here on email which says, if there's a culture in fear in schools inspections, then of course schools will respond. They found the experience positive when asked by Ofsted. What else could they reply? Let's have independent and anonymous feedback on schools inspections.
We will be publishing some more survey data next year, which I think we've used.
Yeah, but what do you say to that idea? That they're not going to be honest.
Totally happy. We get on it. I'm happy that from a whole lot of sources, including from talking regularly to unions, that we get honest feedback, and we are told that there are relatively few issues coming through by unions.
And yet
you say
there's a whole range of sources, including teachers, that are creating anxiety.
I've written it down.
You said there's been, in response to head teachers having very little confidence, this group of head teachers, you said there is anxiety being created. That's in response to me talking about what teachers feel.
Anxious people, anxiety spins around a system. Anxious people sort of transmit their sense of anxiety to other people. It's not necessarily intentional, but anxiety is a thing that ratchets up in many contexts, and defusing that is so important. That's why for years we have been myth-busting. We redesigned inspection on my watch to make it as supportive and constructive as we can within the role that we fulfil in the system. I can't turn into a support service, but I can and have designed inspection to make it as much as possible a supportive professional dialogue between the lead inspector and the head. We do everything to make that work as well as possible.
What's your evidence that there's been anxiety whipped up?
Just looking at the tenor of media, at the amount and tenor of media coverage about this.
Looking at newspaper coverage and media coverage of your organisation.
Newspaper broadcast. Yes, I know that what we do hasn't changed. Underneath, I know that our lives have
changed under COVID. Some say you've been tin-eared to the needs and pleas of schools.
Absolutely not.
I'm now going to tell you what some has been said to us by teachers. You know, you can't say that's just the media. I'm trying to use the people that you are working with and their views of this. But for instance, if we do go back to, the very sad situation, tragic situation of the death of Ruth Perry, there are those who felt like you went silent for 2 weeks after that. You didn't say anything as an organisation. And that was a mistake. Do you regret that?
No, I don't. I think it was a really difficult situation where anything that we said could be misinterpreted. I did do an interview a few weeks later where I was very clear about that inspection. It's very difficult when you've got understandably distressed, grieving family. You cannot enter into a sort of media dialogue. It's simply not feasible.
I understand that must have been extremely difficult, but I'm trying to relay to you the feedback that you don't just get on forms and what people in your industry have said, away from, as you would put it, anxiety in the media. And I wonder if you or anyone senior at Ofsted has ever offered to meet the family or Julia Walters, Ruth Perry's sister.
I've offered at least four times.
Has that happened? Or
no, the invitations have been declined every time.
OK, because I think the other concern was, what did Ofsted learn from that? Was there anything to learn from that? And I should say, you announced some changes in June, giving inadequate schools the opportunity to reverse a rating change within 3 months, depersonalised criticism in reports. I want to make sure we share this, explicitly talking about headteachers could share Ofsted's findings with colleagues before official publication. But the single phrase judgments were retained. Why?
Because they are part of the wider government regulatory system. As I've said, it's exactly the same as the model that's used by for health, for police, for every other kind of public service. And because government uses those judgments in the wider regulatory system, there are 20 or 30 government policies that are directly linked to overall effectiveness judgments. So I cannot take those out unless government decides that it's going to do all of those 20 or 30 things in some other way. I would be sabotaging the regulatory system, which is simply not in my gift. I'm not a politician who can make those kinds of changes. And the people I talk to acknowledge that if the name of the judgment was changed, or if those high stakes consequences were just hung on a slightly different part, then that would become the new sort of high stakes worry thing. So I don't want to rearrange deck chairs. I do everything I can to make what we do as good and as constructive and as positive as we can make it.
There's a charity called Parentkind. We talked a lot about how teachers and those working feel, but about parents now, which represents PTAs, and it submitted evidence to the Education Select Committee in July, which said that while parents strongly supported the idea of inspection, less than a quarter say the current reports are useful to them. What do you say that if parents aren't getting as much use out of these reports as they could, and as we've talked about, you don't accept it, but schools aren't always, who is?
There are three things there. First of all, we piloted our reports with a lot of parent focus groups in all different demographics. We designed them around the needs of parents to get the level and depth of information that most parents want. Parentkind, I think, has particularly strong representation from parents of children with SEND. I may be mistaking that, but it's possible that they would like reports that go into more depth. Within the constraints of the resource we have, we simply can't write longer reports. Government could change that, but we write our reports are as full as we can currently make them.
You know, at the end of this 7-year tenure, you had a 2-year extension. It's been an extraordinary time to be the chief inspector. You started this conversation, and we're coming to a close shortly. You started by saying you didn't want to rate yourself. You didn't want to talk about that. I presume you mean that's for others to think about your legacy, your record. But I just wanted to read you this to get your view on whether these inspections, I know it's not in your gift to do away with certain parts of them or to do away with them at all, but whether they're actually working overall. I recognise you've not changed very much and you think the atmosphere has changed, but a head of a primary school in a very deprived part of Lancashire wanted me to ask you this. Quote, when faced with limited and decreasing funding in a time of increasing need, so that is a change for some of these schools, when schools are buckling under pressure from post-COVID repercussions, increased special needs, etc., the pressure from Ofsted is an easy fix. Why not fix it? You could alleviate the situation where when it reaches Wednesday at 11 o'clock and you know you are free of an inspection for another week, which is say you're given 24 hours notice, your anxiety levels fall and you can actually concentrate on the job you are there to do. Is it time to scrap inspections and rethink the whole regime?
And that itself reflects the whole misunderstanding. All Ofsted wants to see is a school as it actually normally operates. The last thing we want is people preparing, doing complicated things. The short notice we give was actually worked through with the sector. There isn't unanimity of opinion, but we consult very closely with unions on things like that to make sure we're getting to a balance that recognises both the desires of parents who would fundamentally like no notice inspections for us just to turn up on the day, and the sector, which varies between the people who think that very short notice is best because it's less time to worry, or long notice is best. But it's the kind of compromise that we discuss, that we work through to get to a pragmatic best fit. There will always be people who don't like one aspect or another. But we put a tremendous amount of effort into getting something that works for the vast majority. But we will never, with something that has real consequences, there is no possibility of ever doing something that will make everybody happy.
And there's probably no possibility of a teacher feeling like they won't have to prepare. I mean, that's the reality. That's what you would like. But I suppose that's the reality. I should say, many listeners getting in touch, because we didn't just want people who worked in education to say, as a parent, I think Ofsted is doing a good job of informing parents about the quality of schools. It's entirely predictable that teachers and head teachers do not like being held to account. That's their view of this. But it's nonetheless essential. Is that your view? They don't like being held to account?
It's very clear that post-COVID... And you touched on the COVID effect, that there's a stronger sense of any accountability being unfair given what they've been through, and that is really difficult because children are still children. Children still need quality of education. Are we going to say that it doesn't matter if we have more failing schools because COVID, or do we actually need to maintain in the system a lever that helps to identify and helps to get the help and support rapidly to the people who do need it? Actually, it's in everybody's interests for problems to be recognised as early as possible.
Do you have any regrets? It's a long time to be in a role. You've learnt a lot, you've seen a lot.
Well, clearly, all of us would rather COVID hadn't happened.
I meant personal regrets, things you could control.
Things I could control. One of the things, the seminars we've been doing this year for outstanding schools that hadn't been inspected for a very long time have been going down brilliantly. And we've been getting very good feedback on those. I wish we'd started those earlier. But broadly, the changes that I've made to make inspection constructive and supportive, to make it about substance and integrity, I know have gone very well indeed.
Are you disappointed by, though, I suppose, when you have that view of what you've done, are you disappointed by some of the reaction of head teachers today?
It's when you run a regulator, you know that the people that and inspection is part of regulation. You know that there will always be some resistance to what you do. I know that we are hugely responsive and interactive. I know we work with stakeholders on all fronts a great deal to make sure that what we do is as good as it can be in the context we work in.
Am I talking to the next chair of the BBC?
I have no idea, Emma.
Any interviews going on at the moment? You need a new job for January, don't you?
What happens in January is a whole different story.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how we next speak, or when we next speak, because that's one of the rumours about your future. Can you say anything about your future? Are you allowed to know anything?
I can't say anything beyond the fact that I do have a couple of irons in the fire.
Amanda Spielman, keeping your cards close to your chest on that particular front, but not on the other. Thank you very much for coming in and talking to us today.
Thank you.
It's fascinating to hear. And thank you for your messages. And one here from Jill. I've been an Ofsted inspector. I also taught in a school being inspected. The fear and anxiety teachers suffer is extreme, because as one teacher said to me, if you say I'm a bad teacher, it's so personal. It's like saying I'm a bad mother. Jan on email says, my daughter-in-law and son, both head teachers, also have had experience of this. Report that everyone who has been Ofsted-ed recently has reported how very helpful and fair the inspection was. Another one here from Sharon. While our eldest son was sent to a failing school that later went on to special measures, I was quite cynical about the Ofsted reports. I was wrong. It was a dreadful experience before we moved our whole family into the catchment area of an outstanding school. The difference between the two schools was worlds apart. I accept that being on the receiving end of an inspection must be stressful, but as a parent, what else do we have? And so they continue, and I'll come back to those if I can. But here you go, a small topic for you. The future of foreign policy is feminist, I jest. It's a massive one, and it's about the way we live our lives. And that's the claim of the title of a new book by German activist and author Christina Lunz. It's not the first time feminist foreign policy has been touted. It was first introduced by Margot Wallström, who made it her mission to adopt policies with women's needs at the heart of her time. time as Foreign Secretary for Sweden from 2014 to 2019. But what is feminist foreign policy and is it realistic in an increasingly volatile world? Well, Margot Wallström joins me on the line from Sweden. I'm also joined in the studio by the author, Christina Lunds. Warm welcome to you both. Margot, I'll come to you in just a moment. But Christina, if I could start with you. Feminist foreign policy, how do we define it?
Feminist foreign policy is the attempt and the demand to use all diplomatic tools and foreign policy and security policy tools to advance gender equality and justice more broadly globally. Because we know that the most significant factor towards whether a country is peaceful within its borders or towards other countries is the level of equality in the country.
Would you add anything to that, Margot? Hello.
Hello. Well, I would say it's about rights, representation and resources given to women. And I think this is also the definition of feminism, that women and men should enjoy the same rights and obligations and opportunities.
So to take that into a country, Christina, you talk in your book about change needing to happen at a domestic level for a country to change its foreign policy. What evidence do you have that translates?
So there's lots of empirical evidence that the moment we manage to eradicate patriarchal structures in countries which human rights defenders, women human rights defenders, civil society, feminist civil society around the world is trying to do, the moment that we achieve that, the country itself will be less violent also internationally. So feminist foreign policy then is also a lot about governments focusing their goals and priorities in foreign policy making on the demands of affected civil society and feminist civil society in the country.
That's all very well, but what are you going to do when you've got to react?
So,
to something non-feminist that's happened.
Absolutely. So in the book, I'm arguing that we have to distinguish between short, medium and long term. So in the short term, we have to deal with the realities that are out there. So that can include that, of course, in the case of Ukraine, for example, when feminists on the ground or Nobel Peace laureates like Oleksandra Matvichuk, when they demand that they need weapons to self-defense, that can include the delivery of weapon. But in the medium to long term, we need to find ways, which, for example, includes learning from the past. How was it possible that whilst human rights defenders and feminist civil society in Russia, at least since 2000, have really rang the alarm about the increasing attacks on the women's and LGBTQI rights system, that other countries like my own Germany went into even deeper dependence, including energy dependence with such state? So medium to long term, it means learning from the past. It means in Germany, we had this special fund for the armed forces. Olaf Scholz, Chancellor Olaf Scholz, called it the Zeitenwende. In the medium to long term, a feminist approach would mean we had special funds of 100 billion for the improvement of international law, for human rights defenders, for civil crisis prevention, for women's rights and LGBTQI rights around the globe.
Margot, let me give you the chance to maybe talk about where you feel this has started to happen or might be working.
Well, I think that Colombia was a good example of the fact, and this is with this we can show the United Nations, that when women are there at the negotiating table, when they are among the signatories of a peace agreement, these peace agreements last longer. And there is a better chance of having a peace that is sustainable over time. And the problem is that just look around the world today. This is still not the case. More than 20 years since this famous resolution from the United Nations on women, peace and security, women are invisible in most of these contexts. They are still not there at the negotiating table in Ethiopia about what happened in Tigray. And I, you know, we have to really look out for what happens when there is peace, I hope for Ukraine, or when we will see peace in the Middle East. Will there be women as well around the table? Because otherwise, impunity will continue for these war crimes that are directed mostly to women, like rape as a weapon of war.
Yeah, but it was also a great number of men obviously killed in war, and in terms of the fighting and who's in charge of that as well. But because I know that some people feel very uncomfortable with this line of argument because they may have seen a woman leading a country and it not going well. And then there has been women in the past and now there's not women there, but it's not necessarily had the impact. What would you say to that, Margot?
No, the fact is that there is still discrimination against women. There is still so much of prejudice against women. Women make up half of the world's population.
No, of course, but the idea of having them as leaders doesn't always lead to better outcomes.
No, we are not saying that all women are better than men. We would like to think so, but that is, you know, the thing is that women, with their experience, with their background, with everything they know and bring with them, they also have to have a seat at the negotiating table, or they have to become leaders, or they have to be represented in parliamentary context. So it's a matter of democracy as well.
Yes. Let me bring Christina in back at this point, because I suppose if you look around the world as well about who's in power at the moment and the sort of strongman trend around the world, whether it's in Russia or Turkey, you know, we've also just heard about the new Dutch prime minister, as we expect it to be. This doesn't seem to be what you're talking about, doesn't seem to be realistic at the moment, certainly. I don't know what you would say to that.
I guess.
Sorry, may I just get Christina's response first, Margot? Sorry.
Yeah, sure.
You're absolutely right. So we have internationally this increasing trend towards more authoritarian-led countries, more strongmen. We have in history, we're seeing currently the largest illiberal state of democracy since the 1930s. And we have 72% of the world's population living in authoritarian-led countries. And from a feminist perspective, we have to understand that this is strongly linked to the oppression of women's rights. So at my organization, for example, we're working on the so-called anti-feminist movement, which over the past 10 to 15 years has really increased in strength. We have seen between 2009 and 2018, according to a report by the EU, more than $700 invested especially from the US and Russia into Europe to dismantle women's and LGBTQI rights system. So this feminist foreign policy really means making all the dots and connecting and understanding that what the real difference is between solutions and reactions. So what we see a lot internationally in what is happening is reactions to something. And it's not leading to tackling any of the big challenges that we have. That is autocratic regimes, that is strongmen, that is the climate crisis, this is increasing, it's increasing militarization and all of that. But we need something sustainable that really transform the way we're doing foreign policy making internationally to come to better outcomes. And for my work with the Center for Feminist Foreign Policy on a daily basis, it means implementing projects such as how to support human rights, women human rights defenders in authoritarian-led regimes. And it will be a report we are working on, kind of a briefing for governments, for democratic governments. Because very often when we talk to them, they're like, yeah, but we can't, like, how are we supposed to give money or training or anything to human rights defenders in authoritarian-led regimes? They have the ideas. It's about, I mean, what Margot really said, it's about listening to all perspectives. Foreign policy making and diplomacy more generally has been an area for men from a certain region of the world to put through their priorities and needs and assuming that their reality is the reality of everyone, which is why in international theory, they called this theory realism. And so often people would say, oh, but it's not realistic. I mean, it's not realistic what we're seeing out there, believing that bombing something or in inflicting more violence will lead at any point to more human rights, more peace, more human security, more stability in the world. I find that hugely unrealistic.
Christina Lunds, I'm sorry, we're going to have to leave it there. Margot Wahlström, I wanted to come back to you, but the time is the time. Thank you very much for coming onto the programme and making us think about the world in the way that you've been thinking about it, or certainly opening our minds to that if it wasn't already, and just talking about the idea there of the future of foreign policy being feminist. A lot on today's programme. Thank you for your company. Back tomorrow at 10.
That's all for today's Woman's Hour. Thank you so much for your time. Join us again for the next one.
Hello, this is Marion Keyes.
And this is Tara Flynn.
We host a podcast you might like for BBC Radio 4 and BBC Sounds called Now You're Asking.
Each week we take real listeners' questions about life,
love,
lingerie,
cats,
dogs,
dentists,
pockets,
or the lack of
anything really,
and apply our worldly wisdom in a way which we hope will help,
but also hopefully entertain. Join us, why don't you?
Search up Now You're Asking
on BBC Sounds.
Thanking you.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Gail Katz told friends she was leaving her husband, Bob, then went missing. On season one of The Girlfriends, Bob's ex-girlfriends came together to bring him down and seek justice.
I can't believe this.
Now on season two, host Carol Fisher is back, working to solve the mystery of another missing woman.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
Listen to The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, and start listening.